And then there's, of course, also the document of the permanent instruction of the Alta Vendita, which
Yes.
I spoke about in my recent interview with Chris Ferrer about the encyclical. And the Freemasons make it was published by Pope Pius the Ninth. Must be another one of those crazy conspiracy theorists. And he had it from credible sources, from people who had turned from Masonry and converted from it, who had got access to the document, the master plan of the Carbonari for subverting the Catholic Church. And it says that it just acknowledges we'll never get. It's funny. It's like Caiaphas, is saying one man must die for the people. They say we'll never be able to get a real Mason as Pope. What we need is people influenced by our ideas. And to work to infiltrate the church, to get men influenced by our ideas into high places and get one of them made pope and to have a council, and all this will change. And so under Pope Pius the 11th, he actually called several cardinals to talk about a council. And Cardinal Biot, really famous French Jesuit, brilliant theologian, he said you cannot call a council. Because, and he pointed straight to the Alta Vendita, and he said, this is still what they're working at. Just because Pius X condemned modernism doesn't mean they're all still there. Modernism is Masonry, is what he said. And they said, look, even by non-Masons, though, because they're influenced by those ideas. And so then he pointed out, if you have a council, these ideas are going to be foremost and forefront at the council. And sure enough, that's what you happen. And right after Vatican II, what do you see? The Masons are all applauding Vatican II. Not because it taught Masonry formally and out front, rather, but because it showed the influence of their ideas in various places, these ambiguous passages, this fuzzy thinking that then they could go back to afterward, after they convinced everyone it really means X, and they can go and say, all right, now it means Y.
Yes,
It's
and also they're syncretic. They like to sync. They believe that you can meld all religions as long as Freemasonry is above it. Very similar to America in the sense that America is the new order, and you can have all the religions you want as long as you don't try to overcome the state. Freemasons like that, and you can see that that has happened in a certain sense with ecumenism and all the ecumeniacs. They've gone too far with these ideas, and it's become, as it were, Freemasonic in its roots, it seems. It seems that you could trace it to Freemasonic thinking. Also, one could look into Father Fahy. He has a lot to say about the infiltration of the church. Remember what Palau said, you need that for a perfect revolution, you need the state, you need behind the state, the beast giving it power, and you need infiltration, the ram that will breathe words out that are for the dragon, that are for the beast, the state. So that's what we have. We've got that now. We are under the perfect revolution. That's why it can't go on much longer.
Let's tell you, what about the occult leanings of Freemasonry? There's a lot of things in their internal organization. Some things are known because of what was revealed in the 19th century, and other things. What kind of things do they practice? How does that influence society? As we were talking in the beginning about the occult, how is the occult influence too also related to Freemasonry?
Well, I think the Freemasonry loves symbolism, and they have some of their roots in the Knights Templar. And it's been pointed out that the Knights Templar, one of the things they failed to do was to have an apostolate of charity, where the Hospitallers of Jerusalem, the Knights of St. John, did. They were Hospitallers, and the Knights Templar were not. And so when they didn't have anything to do, they got involved in symbols. And these symbols have meaning. In fact, I'm planning on writing an article on embedded art, very dangerous, and I don't know if I'll ever publish it, but it's complicated stuff. You got to be careful with it. But anyway, they would adopt all these occult things. So what's one of the main symbols of Freemasonry would be Egyptian things. Napoleon went down to Egypt. And he resurrected many things Egyptian, and Egyptology became popular. And with that sprang out the occult. In fact, if you look at occult practices, they were occult before the French Revolution. They were hidden, as it were. No one saw them. They were done undercover. But after and during the French Revolution, all of a sudden, these things became more open and practiced and common. And even later, you know, Napoleon was a palm reader. Josephine, she had an obelisk and many other Egyptian things in her backyard. She was always consulting occultists, mediums of sorts. And then in the mid-1900s, or 19th century, you got Alphonsus Louis, who was a seminarian at St. Sulpice, and he left and changed his name to Eliphaz. Alphonsus became Eliphaz, and Louis became Levi, or Levi. And he cataloged tons of occult stuff, and he made the occult popular. He was able to give people access to all sorts of things occult, the Book of the Dead of the Egyptians and all that stuff, which contains curses and words you had to do to get through certain realms when you were dead so that you could continue on. Now, then Blavatsky, I mean, she read his works and she went down to Egypt, and Blavatsky's like, you know, Madame Blavatsky, we're talking like one of the greatest occultists. I call her the devil's Saint Teresa of Jesus. That was his mystical bride. She would speak for him and reveal things. And then the devil's Saint John of the Cross would be Aleister Crowley, who went down to Egypt and received 3 days of revelation from an angel named it Thelema. And in the heart of that law, he said, was the whole heart of this Thelema was do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law. And he tried to enter the Freemasons. Same with Blavatsky, I believe. These things are all connected, this occult rising up. A lot of the Freemason practices are symbolic and occult. Because we've got the sacraments, the devil needs to mock that. He can't. The best he can do is use symbols. If you do these certain symbols and these certain rituals, I will get permission from God to come and do what you want me to do for you. I think that's kind of how I would look at it.
Why is Egypt such an allurement? You even see Egyptian thought in the works of Giordano Bruno, the late 16th, early 17th century eremiticist, apostate Dominican friar, heresiarch of sorts. One of his main influences were works about ancient Egypt that he read through the Greek. And of course, he's falsely today thought to be a scientist, mostly because he thought about the infinity of worlds, which today they call the multiverse. But he was absolutely fascinated. Mysticism, a lot of scientists have gone out there, so they try to make him as this martyr for science. A lot of even atheist scientists have pointed out, wait, we don't want this guy. This guy's a, you know, mystic, nutcase, you know, a magician type of person. And he was chased out of virtually every, he was associate of John Dee's circle in England before he got chased out of England. He was involved in all kinds of other things. So why does the allure of Egypt, Alexander the Great went to Egypt, and he was struck by its practices, and he went to the oasis at Siwa, and where we usually say Siwa anglicized, and he went to the temple of Amun-Ra, and he went in, and they told him, "You are the son of Zeus. You are truly meant to rule the world." And after that, he was convinced that he was a god, and started even the worship of his own cult in Babylon. And of course, in Alexandria, that was started as well, where his body was placed. And of course, they had the cult and the worship of Alexandros Magos, the divine Alexander. And so what are your thoughts on Egypt? Why is Egypt always so prominent in paganism, in of course, the occult after the triumph of Christ?
And Freemasonry, too. Well, you know, it's scriptural. You know, that's where Ham went. Ham, you know, the son of Noah, he was cursed, and he became Egypt. And that curse has been there. It's like if there's one piece of real estate on the earth that has, as it were, the home of the devil, the deserts of Egypt seems to be his home, because it's amazing how many occultists want to go down there and receive revelations, inspirations. They want to look at what the occultists did. And before them and learn from them. So it's one of the most ancient civilizations in the world that was under the power of the devil and organized so, not just haphazardly. There was written books, and there was methods, and there was ritual, and you had to do certain things. So I would say that's part of the reason, and that's, we were winning the battle with the monks out there engaging the devils in the desert with Saint Anthony and others, and we were occupying the devil in his home base, and that, thus the church could overcome so many problems back at home. They were occupying the devils. So yeah, I would say it's the home base of the devil. That's what I'd say. Just, you know, he's a, if we've got Rome as our eternal home, so to speak, he's got his home there in the deserts of Egypt.
I want to read this about Masonry's anti-Christian elements, and this is taken from Freemasonry, the Anti-Christian Movement, by a Jesuit named Cahill in the 1920s, back before talking about it was verboten. So Catholic priests relating these particular manuscripts that were divulged about Masonic rites. And so in one of the rites of initiation, the Masonic wizards come and they say, "Generals, what is the hour?" And the first general says, "It's the ninth hour of the day." Of course, the ninth hour is obviously an important hour. It's in the ancient calculation of time. Before the clock, the ninth hour is 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yes.
Then, so it's the ninth hour, and then the Grand Wizard says, "Then it is the hour when the veil of the temple was rent in twain, and darkness overspread the earth, when the true light departed from us, the altar was thrown down, the blazing star was eclipsed, the cubic stone poured forth, blood and water, the word was lost, and despair and tribulation sat heavenly upon us." Then there's a solemn pause, and the wizard continues, "Since Masonry has experienced such dire calamities, it is our duty to endeavor by renewed labor to retrieve the loss." And so it was privately printed for the Masons. It's from the Rose Croix of Heredum. And so, and again, it's in that book I referenced, Freemasonry, the Anti-Christian Movement by Cahill. So what do you make about that language?
Yeah, that's interesting. I don't know. It's like, definitely that's their home. They're gonna want to go ultimately back to Egypt to find and recover whatever they can. That's their home, and the occult always returns there with all the symbolism they can find. So many people attack the church because we got an obelisk sitting in St. Peter's, and there's various obelisks around Rome, but if you look at that obelisk, it's got a cross on top of it, and it's been exercised, and it symbolizes victory over the occult, that the arms of St. Peter are surrounding it and have it under control, and those who are willing to submit to the church will not have to fear anything from the occult forces. That's what I would say.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. I'm glad you brought that up, because I did want to talk about that. As you see that with people who are awake to issues of the occult and the formations of global governments through all these private agreements and businesses coming together, and which otherwise might be called the New World Order. So people who research that and awake, they're often either Protestants or influenced by Protestant literature. So then what happens is the Vatican and the church is part of the New World Order, and the Jesuits, of course, that old English Civil War propaganda against the Jesuits comes back in force. And you see, look, the Jesuits are trying to take over the world. But what I said earlier, too, about the Jesuits, kind of mocking the idea that they're trying to take over the world. Oh, look, they're down by half since the council, and all those members, and most of them are over their 60s. But then again, with Freemasonry, they're shutting down lodges, they're selling off property, their membership is declined tremendously. So a lot of people point to that and say, oh, the Masons can't be that evil, they can't have that kind of control over the world. Look, they're disappearing, they can't even get any new members. So what do you think of that? Are they disappearing?
They've won. They've done their job. No, I don't think they're disappearing, but you're right. I mean, that's not the right word. They are disappearing. Like you said, the lodges are getting thinner. But they're definitely, their motives and their connections are still very much in place. You know, when you go along with the revolution, you start losing the people that would help you normally because you've revolutionized them. They no longer are motivated. They've been dumbed down. And so you have a less pool to pick from. And ultimately, a revolution is a sort of snake eating itself. It runs out of snake pretty soon. And so, Benjamin Franklin, a Mason, depicted the snake eating itself. That was one of his symbols. But, it's like of course it's going to fall apart because that's the nature of revolution. They want it to fall apart. They want chaos. They want complete and utter leveling of all bastions until they can then reorganize everything after their own image and likeness for those that are able to be around when that happens. They think they're in control. They're very prideful. They think they can survive through all these difficult trials. I think that's part of it. That's part of it. I'm not an expert on those things, though, so I don't want to say anything for definite, but I think that's my understanding is what's going on.
As we've noted, the devil's the author of all revolution. We've talked about the political sphere. How about the scientific sphere? What types of revolutions have been affected in science that have led us into the disorders we see today?
Well, that is interesting. First of all, there's a rejection of the hierarchy of sciences. The idea that there is even a science above physics is rejected pretty much, except maybe mathematics, which is like the queen. And if it's true in math, it must be true in reality. If I can make a mathematical equation out, there must be some truth to it. But so since there's no hierarchy, there's no checks, there's no metaphysics, there's no theology. So scientism becomes possible, like the religion of an ideological driven religion based on science, a certain scientism. That's a problem. You have a state is greater than the church in the political realm, and you have science greater than the faith in the realm of truth. Now, what's interesting, though, is that you see the occult will enter in when inversions like this happen. People are no longer governed by metaphysics. They're governed by more sensory data. You know, if I can imagine something, then it must be true. That's an occult principle. Now, one of the persons who was very wed to that idea was Nikolai Tesla. Now, when Tesla was young, he had a very powerful imagination. It was so powerful that he had to learn to distinguish what he was imagining from what was real. He literally thought he was in another place or time in his imagination. It was so powerful that he had to learn how to know what was in his mind and what was in reality. So powerful was his imagination. Now, it's interesting. Now, he was from, I think, the Yugoslavia. He was like, I can't remember the exact location. His father was an Orthodox priest, but he was not so faithful. And he was one day, and I bring up this story because I think it touches on what you're getting at. He was one day, well, first of all, he was studying electricity and all things of that nature, hoping to help bring about progress in the world in the area of technology. Well, one day after going to college up in Hungary, he was in Budapest, and he was walking in the park, and he'd been working on the electric motor for a while, but he didn't really have any breakthroughs. And he was quoting, he knew Faust, Goethe's Faust, he knew it by heart. And he was quoting it and reading it out loud. And the line he was quoting was pretty important, but I don't remember what it is. It's in his biography, but at that moment, quoting Goethe's Faust in the park, he saw the AC motor as basically we have it today. He saw it all at once in its completeness from A to Z. He saw everything. It was so perfect that he never added to it, I don't think. He simply had to put it to work, and it took him 3 years to bring about what he saw in his mind. That's pretty interesting. You know, he had the whole form of the thing, as it were, infused in him or given to him somehow. And then bang, he could build the best motor. And it's basically the same as we use today to generate electricity or to run something from electricity. Tesla. And he, you know, there's a reason why Tesla is liked by the occultists. There's a heavy rock and band, a heavy metal rock and roll band named after him. And he is kind of a hero of the occult. Another interesting one is a man named Andrew Jackson Davis. He was called the Poughkeepsie Seer back in the 1840s. And he would go into mesmeric fits of ecstasy. And he would see things of the universe. And he was talking about planets and all sorts of stuff. And It's my understanding he predicted Neptune a few years before they actually found Neptune, and he predicted Plato's decades before they found Pluto. He predicted Pluto. So he also said in his ecstatic fits that the universe began with an explosion. That's back in the 1840s. Now, Lemaître came up with the Big Bang way back there, or way later, in the 1920s, I think, some 70 years later. And Arthur Eddington also looked into these things. He's a famous astronomer, reputable. And what's interesting is that a certain individual was there taking notes at many of his ecstatic fits, and that individual was Edgar Allan Poe. Now, Poe took notes, and he wrote his own book, even though he was not an astronomer. Basically, he was acting as a journalist, and he wrote the book Eureka. And in that book, he talks about things of the universe and planets and whatnot. And that's the one that Arthur Eddington looked over and said, for the most part, it's true. Now, you start thinking about that. You say, wait a minute. Occultists told us things of science before they came about. That's okay. Then there's Sir William Crookes, I think his name is. He helped make the vacuum tube and other inventions that helped make the computer possible. He recommended going to seances. He made it known to Tesla he should be going to seances. He can get more information from them. Now, Tesla, I don't need to do that. But he still, it would seem that Tesla was very much into his imagination. But, you know, Crookes was going openly to seances trying to get more information. And finally, one could bring up Blavatsky. She said that the atom was not the smallest particle. There were subatomic particles. She didn't use that exact word, subatomic, but she was saying there were smaller particles. And sure enough, some years later, they discovered smaller particles. Now, put yourself in the shoes of a scientist. These people are telling you about breakthrough information that could lead you to be a millionaire, basically. You could be famous. So they start looking into the occult, trying to get control of it, trying to tap into things and saying, look, we can do this. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, Arthur Conan Doyle became an occultist of sorts, and he was openly angry about the church putting restrictions on this form of knowledge. You know, how dare you restrict us from looking into these things that we can submit to science? Now, there's other elements that we could talk about, like C.G. Jung, Charles Gustav Jung, when he split away from Freud, he found himself without a system, rejected the system of Freud, and he started to try to find another way, and his soul was empty, and he started to talk to his soul, and he says, soul, are you there? And the soul started to talk back to him, and he entered into his imagination through fantasies and dreams. And then he started to dig for information. He literally digged into the earth, you know, the sand, as it were, of the devil. And he dug and he dug and he dug and he dug. And he found a doorway, and a dwarf was there. And the dwarf was the doorkeeper and let him in. And he received a spirit guide named Philemon. And then he saw many things like cruciform figures with snakes wrapped around them. And he met Salome and other people down there. And he had all these conversations with them, and he cataloged them in what is now called the Red Book. It's basically the same size of a Roman Missale, and it was blank, and he filled up all the pages. And that is a powerful book because it shows you this man was almost completely and utterly motivated by occult experiences. So our psychological department in our local university and our doctors are influenced by Jung, who was openly, and now at least, known to be an occultist and received many of his information from occult. So, you know, there you go. One wonders just how occult our society is today. We're swimming in occult things. Swimming. It's amazing.
That's incredible information, Father. And now, even as we speak, this morning, the Supreme Court in a 5-4 decision has basically declared, we talked earlier about the law is what the king and parliament say it is. Well, here we are. add the court to that. The court has now declared that it's unconstitutional to restrict homosexuality. Basically, the Catholic religion, as well as the Protestant religion too, taken at least in terms of faithfulness to Scripture, are now basically those positions are unconstitutional to realize in law. So I want to talk a little bit because we have this what some people have described as a homo-fascist movement. It's not merely people saying tolerate us, leave us alone civilly, and you can see that in the church's history where at certain times they left it alone unless it became a big public problem, such as like in Florence for a number of years. And so you didn't have an active persecution of homosexuality. It was just simply publicly illegal. But now we're not looking at a movement that says, tolerate us, leave us alone. We're having a movement that is in your face. Don't you dare say we're wrong. Don't you dare say there's anything wrong with what we do. Okay, well, since you do, we're going to get the law after you. And that's more or less what they seem to have done. How does this come about? What's the relationship between homosexuality and the occult that we've noted is permeating our society?
All right, one mark of revolution is lust. If you look at the revolutions, they're always releasing man's passions. And that's what drives the revolution. In fact, it's always a marker of revolution is the breakdown of marriages, the free love. So like in the French Revolution, there were many, many very bad situations of lust going on. And even, of course, you've got King Henry VIII before them. Obviously, he was lust-driven. If you look at the connection with the occult, it's interesting when you study it. Go to Madame Blavatsky, for example. She says one of her primary objectives in life is to form a nucleus of the universal brotherhood of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, caste, or color. So sex has got to be put down. It's an occult principle. You cannot make a distinction based upon sex. So here we are, we're seeing it. But really, if you go to Crowley did what was called sex magic. And he found that the more perverse the sexual action was, the more power you could gain with the devil. So homosexual acts were the most powerful he could perform. And he would have someone with him to do those things, and they would get the devils to come out of the ground and talk to them or even enter into them and do things. So it's very much connected to the devil. It's very much occult-based or connected to the occult. Sad to say, we very occult times. So lust, it's amazing to me too, though, that lust as a part of the revolution, it will get you in one way or another. So if you fight against it, you will be attacked. And if you give in to it, then of course you've lost. You're in the revolution. You're swimming in the revolution. If you fight against it, they'll actually use lust against you. You're a pervert. You are perverting children. They'll put them all over the headlines. This priest did this. This priest did that. Galore, because they're fighting the revolution. So lust is a part of the revolution. It's an intimate part, a mark of the revolution. It will tend toward this sort of thing that we're seeing in the Supreme Court.
You see in the book of Genesis, in a couple of places, not just Sodom and Gomorrah, but another one, it escapes me at the moment. I'll link up the scripture verses in the interview notes, where you have societies so radically driven by lust that any man who wanders and sits in the street corner, they have to come out and gang rape them. This happens in not just in Sodom and Gomorrah, but there was another case where I forget.
The tribe of Benjamin.
Yes. And the, they said to him, don't stand on the corner, come in. And then the town came and banged at the door. They wanted the man so that they could gang rape him. And so the man in the end throws out his wife so they could abuse her because he didn't want to violate the law of hospitality. And obviously the scripture is not promoting this. It's just recording the historical fact of it. But, these are the societies that you see that are given over to these violent passions. And so is our society going in that very same direction?
Yeah, as the Marquis de Sade and E. Michael Jones has done an excellent job exposing this in Libido Dominandi, you know, you have the simple passions, which are the sexual passions, will lead to complex passions. In other words, you get angry because you've unleashed the passions in one area. And then that becomes criminal. You start doing criminal actions. And then before long, you become murderous, which is what we're going to have. We're going to have people doing murderous things, and they don't know why they're doing them. They don't really understand that what's going on. They just know they're driven by forces they can't understand. Not everybody will become murderous, obviously, but they can easily become murderous because of their unleashing of these passions. And the more perverted, the more murderous they will become and more heartless. So it's my understanding that the FBI, on their profile for a mass murderer, will have self-abuse as one of the ways of knowing them from their youth. They are always into self-abuse. And then also, it's known among criminals, criminal experts, that the homosexual crimes are oftentimes much more brutal and horrible than those of normal, you know, if we use the word normal, heterosexual people. That alone speaks volumes.
There's always a movement slightly to the left, and then, you know, or just slightly forward, more progressive. I wouldn't even put it left and right terms, just more progressive. Oh, well, you know, it's not harming anybody. It's just two consenting couples, yada, yada, yada. But then you have kind of these subtle increments. So it's like, okay, they're not hurting anybody, leave them alone. But now it's redefined marriage, which potentially has consequences for the church, because the way it works in the United States, at least, and certainly in England, is the church itself is almost an arm of the state that, you know, it comes in, basically it validates a marriage based, you know, it has a legal authority to do that. And if the priest does not have a legal authority in that state, that marriage is invalid as far as the state is concerned, certainly not in religion, but as far as the state's concerned, it is. And in the course, this is, again, a necessary consequence of the Reformation, of the state entering into the whole question of marriage, because previously it was done by the church. But once the state has become above the church, then it has to take over those functions. So now the state marries us. The state says, okay, you're now lawfully wedded and whatnot. And so then the natural consequence of that, again, would lead you to homosexuality. But there's a more pernicious one coming around. You may have noticed, a number of people remarked on it, that the DSM-5, the Diagnostic Service Manual used by psychologists, removed pedophilia as those who want to have carnal relations with children, that removed it as a sign of a psychological disorder. Now, they did this with homosexuality in the 70s, I believe, late 70s, or maybe it was the early 80s, I forget the year. And they removed that. And then, of course, right after that, it's no longer mentally ill. So then the legal basis of criminalizing it now is taken out because, hey, the scientists have said there's nothing wrong with it. The same thing we now see in motion for pedophilia. Are we going in that direction? Because many people say, oh, no, that'll never happen. But we've been that way before, haven't we?
Yeah, that's what what's that called? NAMBLA, National Boy Man Alliance.
Whatever. Yeah, Man Boy Love Association or something like that.
They've been at it for quite a while. So it's like, this is something that is a progress. The river of the revolution is always seeking to make progress. And sure enough, these things will happen. Polygamy will happen. Polyandry, probably. These will all be legalized. It'll just be one perversion after another, because, well, how can they stop it? And once again, you know, the revolution, one of its markers is lust. In fact, you could say that the revolution is a word flowing from the mouth of the devil, and that it has a grammar, and that's lust, ultimately leading to homosexuality. That's its ultimate, you know, Sodom and Gomorrah is its goal. And the more I can get people to commit acts of Sodom, the more they will be mine, possessed by me, blinded by their sin, and unable to repent. So the devil is very crafty in getting the world to go this way. No society has ever survived sodomy. So it can't go on much longer, as we would say. Can't go on much longer.
Indeed, but it does limp along. Now, we've talked about a lot of dire things.
Yeah.
So, you know, so we're getting to this very dire point, and all these things in the average Catholic of goodwill who wants to be holy can legitimately ask, what can I do? I can't fight these things. So we noted revolution is not Catholic. So for morally we're not morally able to revolt and take on the revolutionary, then, you know, we look back to, you know, the Catholics in the Pilgrimage of Grace, the 1549 prayer book rebellions, the Vendée. Yep. They didn't want to overturn the state. And it's one of the things Napoleon noted in his commentaries from St. Helena at the end of his life. He noted that the Vendée had the road open to Paris, but their intelligence simply wasn't good enough, and they never seemed to have the interest in going to Paris and stopping the revolution. And they wanted the restoration, just like the prayer books. So militarily, these were meant to fail. Especially the prayer book rebellion, because militarily they had a greater force than the king possessed. He had to bring in foreign mercenaries to put them down, Edward VI and his regency council. And they controlled all of Exeter. And they could have marched on the crown, but they didn't. They wanted the restoration. And from a military standpoint, as a military historian, I can tell you that that's a losing position militarily. So taking on the military solution to be the real revolutionary also is not the Catholic solution. So what should good Catholics do to work for the restoration of Catholic social order? I take it it's not write your congressman.
Yeah, I think some do write their congressmen. You know, like there's some groups that have signature drives and have peaceful public efforts. And I think this is permissible. It's not revolutionary, but it only is going to slow down things. It's never going to reverse things. What we need to do is restore, and restorations come from above. So it's got to come from God. It cannot come from us. And I think that's part of the lesson from the Pilgrimage of Grace, the prayer book, so-called rebellion, the Vendée, the Cristeros, because they wanted to restore, but they didn't have that leader established from above. And we're prophesying that that will happen. There will be a great king, and there will be a great pope, and they will come, and they will restore order. This is from multiple saints. It's very safe to believe that and hold it and have hope that things will be restored. But if you lose hope in even, you know, the future and the things, you can look back. It's very important to go to the Maccabees. The Maccabees is right before the coming of the first time that Christ came. So they represent what things are going to look like before the second coming of Christ. And so they're very important for our time. They're like a type. And so you think about it, one family preserved Israel for Christ, the Maccabees. One little girl saved France from falling into the clutches of future, basically, Henry VIII. That was Joan of Arc. One little girl, for the most part, brought the Pope back from Rome. It doesn't take much when God's involved, but we need to cooperate with God to be ready to be that instrument that will help the restoration. And looking at the Maccabees can help a lot. If people would just pray over and read and meditate on the Maccabees, they would learn so many things about how to prepare for a true counter-revolution. And a couple of the things are they prayed. They kept vigil. Here's the key one. They looked into the old ways. They studied. You know, you go to St. Thomas More, you mentioned him earlier, and if you study St. Thomas More, at least the book I read by Peter Ackroyd, I think I listened to it three times. And in that book, he mentions that Thomas More, at the beginning of his life, as active works, was a humanist of sorts. And then as he realized the end of this humanism, where it was leading, he once said, we got to go back to Thomas. We got to restore the schoolmen. That's why he's a saint, because he recognized that this humanism that was coming up was not good.
And it was St. John Fisher, too, that actually restored him, because when he worked with Henry VIII to fashion the Defensio Septem Sacramentorum Contra Lutherum, the defense of the seven sacraments against Luther, Henry, in the dedicatory epistle to Leo X, made a great, resounding defense of the papacy. And he wrote it in, and More actually said, you should take this out. And Henry debated about it, because More was a big friend of Erasmus. Actually, yeah. So was St. John Fisher, but he was certainly aloof from a lot of Erasmus's errors. And So More was on that track of the papacy is just a human institution.
Yes.
It has some basis of some sort, but not any kind of serious power in the church. And then as he got into refuting, you know, writing against Luther and Tyndale and others, he realized his weakness as a theologian. So he went to the man celebrated as the greatest theologian in Christendom at the time, who's quoted more than anyone else in Trent's Decree of Justification, St. John Fisher. And St. John Fisher made a lot of use of St. Thomas, read the Fathers, and just propounded, again, the defense of the papacy and its confutation of the assertions of Luther. And I've read it in the Latin, and it's wonderful. It's actually one of those works I've got to get translated. And that convinced More. As More read more deeply, and he read Thomas, and he read the Fathers through Fisher, he realized the papacy is a divine institution, even as Henry was going in the opposite direction.
Yes.
For the convenience of his lust.
And Erasmus, in some ways, too. He did not help us with his mega mind.
He
saw the error of Russia, we could say, that was taking hold in England and not uniting themselves with the Pope. But if you go to the Maccabees, they also did things like detach. They were ready to let go of things. You know, Americans have a hard time detaching from all their material goods. They had a spirit of true poverty. They were willing to make reparation for wrongs. Family life was of key importance to them. They were pious people. They were modest. Very modest. They would not go to those gymnasiums. They made true sacrifice. So those are the things I think that need to be done by good Catholics, fulfilling their duties of their state and life, come what may. They will be an instrument of God to help bring in a restoration.
It's interesting, you mentioned the Maccabees and that question of the gymnasion in Greek. The gymnasion in Hellenistic culture had an explicit association with cult and ritual homosexuality.
Wow.
And when they set one up in Jerusalem, because it was the Hellenistic thing to do, it was the new thing, because Hellenistic things, and people usually think in philosophy, Plato and Aristotle and such things, but Hellenistic culture was wider. It was the culture of the royal courts of the successors of Alexander the Great. And the gymnasion became this ritual celebration of homosexuality, as it was done in a lot of the courts, like in Ctesiphon up on the Euphrates near modern Baghdad, which was the capital of the Seleucid Empire, which is what the empire the Maccabees fought against. And likewise in Alexandria as well, which was the head of the Ptolemy Empire. But also, and this leads us into our next question, what the Maccabees were confronting were the proto-ecumenists, because the Seleucids got in a war with the Alexandrians, with the Ptolemies, and they were winning until Rome got into the mix, and they lost, and then they came back and they said, we need unity, we need troops, you know what, those Jews are troublesome, they don't like paying taxes, they don't like, but why? And then they tell Antiochus IV, he's called Antiochus Epiphanes, the illustrious Epiphanes in Greek. And he decides, oh, well, here's the problem then. You know, these Jews, they don't worship our gods, right? That's probably one of the problems. They're offending our gods. So they go down to Jerusalem and they say, hey, Zeus, Yahweh, same God. Right? You know, it's the same thing. So we'll, you know, you worship Zeus and we'll worship Yahweh and we'll all be nice and happy. We'll have our we'll have our nice, you know, prayer meetings together and everything. I mean, something similar to that. It wasn't quite as modern as that, but it was that idea. You worship on our altars, we'll all worship on yours. We'll all be part of one polity. You'll pay your taxes and not offend our gods. And the Maccabees, when this was brought down to Judas Maccabeus's village, and they said, okay, you know, here we're setting up an altar to Zeus right here. You know, who's going to be the first to conform to the reforms that we're initiating in your country? And of course, the Maccabeus stood up and he refused to do it. And he slew and he's held as righteous for doing this. He slew the first Israelite that offered a pig on the altar to Zeus. And so now today, we see, of course, you mentioned it earlier, we talked a bit about Vatican II and Masonry, the ecumenists of today, right? And it's not merely, as Cardinal Casper continues to tell us, it's not an ecumenism of return. We need to dialogue. But proselytism, as this Pope Francis said, is nonsense. We don't want to convert anybody. Well, how does Vatican II play into the revolution? We have Catholics on the enemy's side, right? We have members of the hierarchy. You had this great march for the family in Rome to support the family. And it even has Jewish and Muslim clerics present. There's not a single bishop present, not even a message from the Pope to all these people gathered in front of his cathedral in Rome to support the family. Not even a message. You have, in America, we have Catholics who are on the enemy's camp in government. Nancy Pelosi, Joe Biden, and the list can, you know, go down, and people are publicly, not just voting, publicly supporting abortion and homosexuality, coming out with these absurd theological positions and trying to defend it as if this is somehow a theological position. So how does Vatican II play into the revolution where Catholics, we should be united and faithful to oppose it, but we're not?
Well, Vatican II, from what I can understand, and this comes from Dr. Ron MacArthur, too. He has a good talk on Keep the Faith on this. How come we're in this position? Well, because they were tired of fighting the revolution. They were tired of fighting the revolution. And in a sense, they were tired because of the Galileo affair, too. That really has a huge element to play. But they were tired of fighting, so they said, let's get along with the revolution. Let's try to... Of course, many were not so good-willed about it. Let's see what's good in the revolution, and let's open the windows, and let's try to get along, and let's start over again, as Yves Congar tried to say. You know, we should overcome a fossilized tradition. Everything must be started again, as though we were in the first centuries of the church. So we're going to just skip all the Christ the King stuff, the social reign of our Lord and Savior, and all that stuff that went in between. Let's just be St. Paul. And let's just start over. Let's just go out in the world and just talk to people about God and dialogue with them. And really, what it ended up happening, though, was that this was planned. This was done carefully. This was by recognition of those who were in the Vatican Council itself and after, that it was the French Revolution, as it were, in a peaceful manner entering the church. Cardinal Souvenens, he said, Vatican II is the French Revolution in the church. This is scary stuff. Cardinal Ratzinger, before he ascended to the throne of Peter, remarked that Gaudium et Spes, one of the major documents of Vatican II, represents on the part of the church an attempt at an official reconciliation with the new era inaugurated in 1789. That's Cardinal Ratzinger, now Pope Benedict XVI, emeritus. He wrote the another one wrote, the Vatican newspaper, in fact, said the church has assumed and surpassed the liberal democratic requests or conquests of the French Revolution. So, I mean, there's, you know, those are just a couple of quotes. We see that, you know, some have called the gathering of the fathers in the Vatican II, which is a legitimate council, legitimately organized and called, but the outcome was basically like the Estates General. It was the French Revolution in the church. One cardinal even called it the October Revolution. So what's the result? Well, we have a new order on every level. We have a new order on every single level of the church. And underlying all the new things is a mitigation from the old or even an inversion. So the church used to be the teacher. Now she's a listener. She's a student of the world. She's trying to discover something about herself. Before, she was the only way to salvation. Now we're trying to gather forces to go together. How it is, we were trying to progress to a future reality in which no proselytization and whatnot is required. We're all going to kind of converge, a future convergence. That's actually in some documents, the idea of convergence. So she's no longer a mother. She's a sister. She's an apologizer. I think one interesting point that shows this more maybe than others is Pope Paul VI. I think it was even during the council. It was in Roberto Mattei's book on the Second Vatican Council. He speaks of how Paul VI went to the UN and gave that famous speech about how the future of the world depends on the UN. And then he stood for the first time. The Pope stood giving a sermon like that, an address, and he was below three of the main leaders of and rulers of the UN at that point. So he was actually below people, which has never happened before with the Pope. And here he was standing. So you see, wow, something really big has happened. We have had an inversion, a disorientation of what we had before. That's how I would look at it. Basically, the revolution, we looked into it and tried to get along with it, and it flooded the church. And now, using von Balthasar, they're trying to bring down any bastion that is still standing. You know, all the bastions have got to be leveled. There's got to be egalitarianism. And one of the last bastions is the papacy. So now we've got the powers of the papacy be giving this year to people, even to absolve various heinous crimes. You know, you can think about it. What they never mentioned pedophilia. What about pedophilia? That's a crime that requires the Pope to look into. Well, you just allowed now. I mean, no one's crying out. It's interesting. Wait a minute. What about this one? Yeah, some guy did this with the Eucharist. So I'll give this guy the power to go and dissolve that. But no one's making an outcry about the pedophilia crime. You know, it's just scary stuff. What we're seeing is a leveling of the last, one of the last bastions, which is the papacy. That's what I think of the answers that question, I hope. Maybe not too much.
Well, you know, it certainly goes in the right direction. I mean, there's probably many, it could probably be a 2 or 3 hour podcast in itself on the subject.
Exactly.
But so you've been with us for a very long time, Father, and I appreciate the time you've given us. So the very last question, sort of bring it full circle. You spoke in the beginning about chiasms, and about, of course, how it's shaped, you know, like the Greek letter key. It's a Greek letter key. It's a literary device, in case people don't know. If you've studied Latin or Greek, you know its use in poetry. You draw attention and emphasize points by inverting them, and that's chiastic. It's a march against the prevailing order. So we talked about counter-revolution and how this plays out. And of course, as you've given in other talks about chiasms in some of your other sermons, you have to have your chiasm right. You have to have everything right in your chiasm, or more problems develop. So now, traditional Catholicism proposes itself as the counter-revolution to Satan's revolution, to the infiltration of the church before and after Vatican II. In your experience, what problems does it have in its chiasm that it has to expunge before it can properly be counter-revolutionary?
Okay, the biggest thing I see is there is a lack of adherence to and respect for legitimate authority. You know, God is the author of all authority, and if someone's in a position of authority, even if he's a creep, he does have the power of God. You know, you don't have to have faith. Unfortunately, this is the way God made it. It's not unfortunate, it's the way God made it, but you don't have to have faith to exercise authority. You know, Pilate exercised authority over our Lord even. He submitted himself to Pilate. You would not have authority over me if it were not granted you from above, as he said, our Lord himself. So what I find is that one of the biggest problems with traditional-minded people, traditional Catholics, is that they have lost their respect and piety, their respect for authority. And they've read a book and they know more than everybody else. And they get on these blogs and they're just knee-jerk reactions, and they write things and they're really out of line. Some of these blogs, their disrespect for the Pope or the papal office is horrible. It's lamentable. You know, I'm not fond of Pope Francis, but you know what? He's the Pope. And I've got to treat him with respect when I speak of him in any official manner. Or just say, someone said this, and just explain what's wrong with it without attacking the person. I find there's a lot of people attacking the person today. So you get this personalism gone amok. If they can't make a personal connection with the Pope, they feel free to bash the Pope. They've fallen into the revolution themselves. So ultimately, this is what I think is the problem. Traditional Catholics, not realizing it maybe, but they're using revolution to fight revolution. they need to get their minds around what revolution is and realize all revolution is bad and it cannot be used for good. And they should never use the word revolution in any way whatsoever in a positive way, because that falls right into the devil's plan. And second of all, they should restrain themselves in these blogs and their commentaries and speak with respect, show what's wrong with what the statement is without attacking the person or taking a jibe at them. You know, this is not America. That's what they think. They're like in American politics. I can attack the president at will because this is free politics in America. Well, this is not the way God made things. This is revolutionary. I also think that they have a little bit of knowledge. They're suddenly theologians, you know? They don't realize where we are in the revolution as well. I think that we're in a wrath. Grace isn't available in large quantities and superabundance. So we have to slow down, you know, and be patient. We haven't turned the corner yet. What trads need to do is fulfill their duties of their state in life the best they can. And God will do the rest. He'll make them that Maccabees. He'll make them a Joan of Arc. He'll make them a Catherine of Siena. Now, there's one last element, I think, that could be discussed, and that's personality thing, again, is that when they do find a personality they like, usually a priest, because they're looking for a priest that will actually guide them, even though they despise all these other priests, they're looking for a priest that they can honor, but they end up honoring them in the wrong way. They end up making them into a sort of cult of personality. And then that ends up hurting the priest. And there's been many of these cults of personality priests that have just been devastated. They're gone. They're scandals. The devil loves them because he can get them to fall. So, you know, one thing trads, I think, need to do is lay off the cult of personality on the priesthood, look for the truth and Jesus Christ crucified, and listen to your priest as if you were listening to God in some sense. In other words, they've got a test. I agree. I'm with them all the way. Test what he says. See if it's got a pedigree to it. Look, see if it's of tradition. But don't despise the priest if he makes a mistake. Honor the priest regardless. And never despise or look down on priesthood or the priest. It's very dangerous. God will not help you if you start doing that. He will honor the priest before he honors you, even if he's a scumbag in some ways. He always has honored the authority system of his church. Even if you're right, and the saints have shown this to be true time and time again. You know, I'm reminded of one story, and I'll end with this, but it's a marvelous story of Venerable Mother Mary of Ágreda. She's very ill, and her book has finally been known to the Inquisition and other things. So some inquisitors come down to see her, and they have to carry Mother down to see them. She's so ill, and they insist that she kneel before them. She did. I'm not sure I would have had her kneel, but she knelt for 3 hours answering questions for 11 days, 3 hours in the morning and 3 hours in the afternoon. And after it was over with, she got better as it went along. Her illness ceased. And she never complained about them. And she says, I appreciate the Inquisition all the more now. I understand what they're doing and why they're doing it. They have my devotion. But not only that, the Inquisitors, when they were done with her, they were practically on their knees before her. Can we write you? Will you pray for us? Help us. See, there is a saint who recognized the authority of God in these men. Even though it was torturous for her at first, it ended up paying off in the end. And so I think that's just a good example of how you respect authority. God will help you overcome a difficult matter.
That's the way of the saints, too, to respect the proper authority. And we spoke earlier about Morton Fisher, St. John Fisher. When Bishop Warham died, the Archbishop of Canterbury, then the Boleyn family promoted their family chaplain, Thomas Cranmer, to the, and he had already been in discussion with Henry, and he was the one who went to Henry and said, "Psst, we see kings in the Bible, but where do we see popes? I don't see popes. popes in the Bible? Do you see popes in the Bible? I don't. Therefore, why are we even trying this whole canonical process? And that influenced Henry very strongly. And so he made Cranmer the Archbishop of Canterbury. So before the break, the formal excommunication of Henry, and of course the schism and everything, Cranmer was legitimately the Archbishop of Canterbury, even though Fisher knew he was a flaming heretic. So he still submitted himself to the authority of Cranmer, whether he liked it or not, and even gave him due respect as his superior. You know, and he did never despised to do so. And that's the way of all the saints. Saint Ignatius of Loyola, I mean, if you read his life, he got chased out of Spain. They did not want any new things coming in Spain, new orders or anything. And he got set before the Inquisition. That the spiritual exercises went to the Inquisition, I don't know how many times it did in Spain. And it always got a clean bill of health, but it caused him a lot of struggle and annoyance. They even in Paris, they threatened to flog him, because he's spreading around this book that didn't have approbation. Then they went through and they found that this was actually very good. And so, but he never complained about the Inquisition. He never said, oh, those jerks, those losers, those modernists who wouldn't take a look at this is all based on tradition, etc. You know, he gladly submitted to their authority. And that is a huge problem. People who read a book and understand it sufficiently that they think now they're a theologian. So where they read a book on the rubrics of the Mass and they think that, oh, Father's not doing this, this, and this. The book might be from 1920 and they don't realize that a few things changed between then and 1962. And the priest is obliged to use the rubrics in use in 1962, even if he may prefer, my opinion rightly, previous rubrics.
Yes.
So they might not realize that, and they'll just jump off, you know, the board and attack the priest. And I think that is a huge problem. It's also a problem in the Novus Ordo, too. You see the so-called germ warfare. People argue about the germ, the general instructions of the missal. And, the Father's not doing this right. It's like this constant battle to get the liturgy right. I think that's part of what carries over into the trad movement. But everything else, too. We know better because we have the access to all these means, and it's not being used prudently.
Exactly.
Well, Father Ioannis Petrus, thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome. It's been good to be here.
All right. God bless you.
God bless you, Ryan. Have a good day.
You too.